They say if we can get to the south pole of the moon, we can convert some of the frozen water we find into rocket fuel that will take us on to the next best place. That leads us to ask, can water be made to fuel our food chain?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1350th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Port Stanley who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com or on Spotify or who knows where. Well, wherever you are and whoever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, this just in, from Reuters no less, Russia has launched its first moon landing spacecraft in 47 years in a bid to be the first nation to make a soft landing on the south pole of the moon. Well, the Russians are racing to beat India, which launched its Chandrayaan-3 lunar lander last month, and also with the United States and China, both of which have advanced lunar exploration programs targeting the lunar south pole. Why are these mighty nations racing to the south pole of the moon? Gold? Diamonds? Blue cheese? No! The race is on for ice. Over 600 billion kilograms of water ice, enough ice to fill 240,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. That's a lot of ice, don't you think? Didn't even know the moon had any, but it does. So, why race to the moon for ice? Because that ice could be made to provide air and water for an army of people and fuel for their rocket ships. And get this, whichever nation controls the ice controls the moon. So, this race to the moon leads those of us stuck here on Mother Earth to ask, can water be made to fuel our future? Well, who better to ask than our green energy consultant, Mike Keller, who is the Michael in Michael A. Keller and Associates Consulting. Mike, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Michael. It's nice to be here.
We have a Mike and we have a Michael. That way we know which one's which. One's a Michael and one's a Mike. So your resume claims that you help people create bankable energy feedstock supplies from submerchantable material for agricultural-based conversion technologies, including gaseous hydrogen, anaerobic digestion, and biomass to energy projects. So, Mr. Consultant, how are we going to convert water, ice, into rocket fuel up there on the moon?
Sure. Well, I guess first you have to thaw it, but you can do that.
Might be a job, just trying to figure out how to thaw it, right?
Could be. Basically, water is, H2O, which is a hydrogen and two molecules of oxygen. Or two molecules of hydrogen and a molecule of oxygen. And the technology is pretty simple. You use electrolysis or an electronic charge to separate those two components into hydrogen, comes off as a gas, and then oxygen. So to make hydrogen out of water is extremely efficient, and and it's pretty simple to do. It's just one of the reasons it's not done more here on Mother Earth is because, water is extremely precious. And so most of the technologies rely on fresh water. But there is emerging technology now that will convert seawater and nasty water, from sewage treatment plants, into hydrogen as well. So that's coming along.
So the hydrogen could be used to fuel our rocket ships.
So, that's correct.
So if we can get to the south pole of the moon and grab a hold of all of that water ice, we can convert it into rocket fuel and air because yep. whoever's up there guarding the water ice is going to have air. And so that's the reason we're racing, right?
I would think so, yeah. It's but there's plenty to do right here on Mother Earth too with the hydrogen, because it's a prime replacement for fossil fuels, for transportation and for power generation and so on. It's a very versatile element.
Well, even this morning when I was learning about our race to the moon, I see where the technology is such that they're talking about converting jet engines to hydrogen as well, which, of course, yep. would really change the nature of air travel and of the pollutants that we expel as we're blasting our way across the altitudes. What difference would it make to use hydrogen instead of the fossil fuels?
Hydrogen is essentially carbon free, and the problem, or the greatest complaint, I guess, if you will, of aviation fuel or aviation emissions, is that they're much more they have a much greater effect on the atmosphere because you're doing it at such high altitudes. So the production of sustainable airline fuel or aviation fuel, I should say. Also known as SAF. SAF production is really a great quest for all of the airlines to cut down on the harmful effects of carbon emissions on climate change. Mm-hmm. So that's the biggest. I mean, that's kind of like the holy grail of hydrogen for transportation fuel is SAF.
Okay. And so when those aircraft are flying at high altitudes, 37,000 feet up there in the sky, and they're spewing out all of this carbon waste from the fossil fuels, that carbon particles just hang around. They float around up there for a while, don't they?
Yeah, and I'm by no means an expert on this subject, but it's way more intense on the atmosphere than if you're emitting those emissions driving down the highway. And because it's way up there, you don't have a chance for it to become absorbed from photosynthesis through trees or plants and that type of thing. The soil, the ocean, the two biggest carbon sinks on the planet, don't have the ability to reach that far into the air, you know, to get those carbon emissions. So it really is a problem for the planet, and also it's a very complex problem to correct, mm-hmm. you know, to find a replacement for aviation fuel.
Well, even here on Earth, hydrogen energy seems to be popping all over the place, kind of like mushrooms on a after a rainfall. It's just hydrogen here, hydrogen there. Toyota Motor Company, the leading motor company of the world, seems to be eschewing the EVs, electronic vehicles, for hydrogen power. And you would have to believe that Toyota knows something. So all of these stories are popping up. What is causing all the stories to pop up as they are?
Toyota, I mean, specifically, I think is covering all their bets. I mean, they're not, you know, they're not bypassing or eschewing, as you say, electric vehicles. They've got, you know, they brought in the hybrids.
Yeah, they invented the hybrid, right.
Yeah, and really developed that market. But the, I've been working with Toyota for their Toyota Susho, the parent company of Toyota Motor Company, for their Port of Los Angeles and their Port of Long Beach facility. And they made a public statement that they want to convert all the cargo handling equipment down there to they want to decarbonize that port. And so they do it. It's as much practical, I think, if I had to, you know, give my opinion about it, it's as much practicality as it is environmental. They've got, I don't know, it's several thousand of these, they're called top loaders, material handlers that take the cargo or the cargo container, the shipping container off of a cargo ship and put it onto a drayage truck. Then the truck leaves. And so these top loaders, they run 12, 14 hours a day, and then they all have to charge at the same time. So, but they charge at night. And when the sun is not out and the solar cells are not charging anything. So they have to have, but then the time to actually charge these things is, and because of the number of them, it's physically, I mean, it's just not practical to charge that many vehicles using EV chargers, even if it was on the fastest one, because of the infrastructure required. So what Toyota realized is that if they used hydrogen, a hydrogen fueled piece of equipment, and so they can charge it in less than an hour. And so they can charge everything for a fraction of the cost and a fraction of the time that it would take to otherwise to do an electric vehicle. So it's a very much of an economic move on their part, and it just happens to help the atmosphere, and it makes it a much more profitable situation for them. So what they do, Michael, I'll continue on for just a moment, but they will use fuel cells, that sit idle, and they charge them during the day with basically green electrons or solar power, and it converts it into hydrogen, and the hydrogen is stored in these fuel cells. So then they hook up the equipment to these fuel cells, and they charge in like 10 or 15 minutes. And, so one fuel cell will charge multiple top loaders. And it's everything is charged. They have zero emissions, and they really help the air quality around the port of Los Angeles as well as Long Beach.
Well, it seems like a very good deal all the way around to produce energy from water, and I love the idea. Go ahead.
They're not going to from water. They're doing it. They've got to go outside to purchase hydrogen from wherever they can, and that's the issue right now. Is there's just not enough producers of hydrogen to fuel just one single port, let alone two ports, or they have seven ports, I guess, in North America.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, riding along with Mike Keller, who is the consultant at Michael A. Keller and Associates, talking about hydrogen and the possibility that it is the next energy source. It is the new world in which we'll live sometime down the line. People have been talking about it for a long, long time. And so when we come back from this break, I'm going to ask Michael, if hydrogen is the fuel of the future, why can't we have it today? Do stay tuned. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson and Mike Keller. Michael and Mike, right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, yes, we are back on the food chain. We're looking for what's eating what with respect to energy and how we're going to fuel our future food chain. Nobody wants to use gasoline because it's dirty, pollutes the air, and costs a lot of money. So is there an alternative? Well, we look to electricity. We look to the windmills. We look to those things where we can get what we think of free electricity, but I'm not sure, so sure that it's all that free. But hydrogen poses a very interesting possibility. And my question to Mike Keller, who is a consultant in the industry, is that if hydrogen is the future, why can't we have it now? That's your question.
Okay. Well, it's really interesting, but the number of reasons for it, but the biggest one is there's just no infrastructure. Like 10 years ago, there wasn't much of an infrastructure for EVs, electric vehicles. And so today, you're seeing charging stations pop up everywhere. And there's a tax, it's putting a great stress on the grid for all these EVs and et cetera. And then, switching away, California is mandating, we can't use gas stoves. All homes must be electric. And so this demand for electricity is just skyrocketing. And so there's this massive push to put infrastructure in for the increased, load demand on the power network, on the power grid. It's similar to the hydrogen, except the hydrogen, it's essentially a flat start. So you've got to find the fuel to make the hydrogen, and then you've got to have a market to sell it into. Just a chicken and egg situation. So that's the of all the different. There's probably 5 or 6 different kinds of hydrogen. It all depends on how you produce it, and then the engines that it's going to go into. But the most promising market are over-the-road trucks, because they're the over-the-road trucks that go from, New York to LA or something like that. They'll use hydrogen because it's faster to fuel and to fill them up, like 15, 20 minutes, versus 45 minutes or an hour for a big rig truck, and then you don't have the battery weight. So there's that seems to be the emerging market right now. And companies like Nikola, they're building Love's Truck Stops, Pilot, they're planning to put in hydrogen fueling station for over-the-road trucks. And now they're looking for producers of hydrogen. So they're kind of working both ends against the middle. And I'm on the upstream side, and those guys are on the downstream side, distributing it to end users.
Good, Mr. Upstream side. How do we make hydrogen fuel? What do we do?
Well, the way that,
we split atom, right? We split the molecule.
Yeah, and so what we're doing is we're taking organic material, in this case, woody biomass. Woody biomass, you see the tree trucks going around your neighborhood and grinding up the tree trimmings and that type of thing. But we need to have it in vast quantities, and we need to have it for, pretty much of a guaranteed supply to cover the cost of building these plants. So what happens is we've gone to the national forest in California, and this is true across the country and across the world, is they'll go in and they will thin trees out. You mentioned at the introduction. They get rid of what's called submerchantable or submerged material.
Wait a minute. That's an interesting word. I like it. Submerchantable material, which means you can't sell it.
You can't sell it. So it's for the last 2 decades at least, it was a misguided attempt at forest management. To let the tree just die in the forest, and you know, if it falls over from, let's say, a disease or drought, you know, they say, well, just let it rot into the ground. Well, that resulted in a tremendous amount of wildfires, and the, you know, which burned the last several years in our state and elsewhere, causing, you know, billions of dollars in property damage and loss of life. So now with the U.S. Forest Service, CDFA here in California, California Department of Fire and Agriculture, Forestry and Agriculture, they found that
it was a good Freudian slip there.
Well, they'll go in and they'll thin the forest out. They'll get rid of the skinny trees that there's no value for. They'll get rid of the dying trees that, you know, that survived the last fire, but they're no longer useful as making dimensional lumber. And then infested trees by the bark beetle as one, the most notorious in the Western states. They just crumble when you cut them down. So, but it's worthless to a sawmill, but they're very valuable for fuel production. So the technology that we use we'll use pyrolysis, which means high temperature and low oxygen. So these trees, you put them, you grind them up or you chip them up, and you put them into these continuous flow ovens, if you will, and they'll get really hot, and they'll just start to break down.
Mike, isn't that the same process by which the Amazonian indigenous peoples made biochar?
You are spot on, Michael. The effects of the soil fertility that was a result of this is created this highly fertile soil in the Amazon. So what we are going to do, and others like us, is we're taking this, and when it gets to that high temperature, it gives off what we call a synthetic gas or a syngas, which is a combination of hydrogen, methane, CO, and CO2, and probably some others in there that I have forgotten. And they will use different technologies to separate the hydrogen out, and then they'll use the methane, and they'll cycle that back into the furnace, if you will, the retort, and it just burns itself. So you have zero emissions. You take the hydrogen out, and you're getting rid of trees that otherwise would eventually turn into greenhouse gas, most notably methane, just from breaking down, and carbon dioxide. So this is a way of reducing, adding to forest health, and reducing emissions. And then the biochar that's left over, the charcoal, if you will, is 90% plus or minus a couple of percent pure carbon. And that carbon is very porous, and it is an excellent soil additive. And so it can, it's been proven to sequester carbon. There's carbon credits available for it, but that carbon remains fixed in the soil for well over 100 years. And it improves soil fertility, soil retention, increased crop performance. I mean, just everything that you can imagine. So it really is it's a closed cycle that is just really getting started in California and elsewhere.
And interestingly enough, it's the technology by which the Amazonians built huge civilizations in the Amazon jungle before Europeans showed up on the scene with their diseases.
Bless their heart.
But you can still find that terra preta, that black earth, in the Amazon, and people actually sell it as a garden fertilizer. So, you know, this is sounding too good to be true, Mike Keller.
Well, it actually is true, and it's doable, and it's so putting the pieces together has been challenging but very rewarding. Mm-hmm. And the Inflation Reduction Act passed last year, I believe, by President Biden. You know, it provides tremendous number of incentives for producers to take this and to take this submerged material and turn it into hydrogen. And so there's a lot of incentives otherwise, you know, to do this. And it's really starting to get traction now.
Well, you are working with the Thule.
Thule River Economic Development.
Yeah, Thule River Economic Development Corporation, which is a corporation that helps the local Indian tribe down there manage their land, and you're teaching them how to do this. So I think it would provide a really good practical example of what you're talking about. Do you want to take us through that?
Sure. So the Thule River Nation and many other federally recognized tribes in California and elsewhere, especially in California, a lot of their land is national forest. And so the reservation goes up and into the national forest. So when a wildfire happens, it threatens life and limb. It's like the Paradise Fire, the CZU fire we had here a few years ago. And plus the economic opportunities are just not that many of them for tribal nations. So what we've decided to do, or we put our heads together and said, you have all of these trees that need to come out. And there's about, 100 plus tons per acre per year of submerchantable material that you can take out. And so the idea is, rather than leave them there, which increases the risk of fire because there's all this fuel laying around. So you take it out, you're creating jobs, then you're creating this hydrogen fuel, which can be used to generate electricity, to charge EVs. It can be used for transportation fuel, and it could be sold to other companies that are upgrading it to, say, green ammonia or sustainable aviation fuels we spoke of a few minutes ago. But there's a lot of optionality that can be done. So it's creating jobs. It's helping the environment. Reducing the wildfire risk. When you talk about it, it's a win-win all the way across the board.
Yeah, but surely there must be something wrong with it, because it sounds like an ecologist delight, because you're doing everything you should be doing.
Well, I'm not sure what the biggest gripe would be, other than, well, you're using government money to do it. And well, okay, if that's the biggest one, then, I'll take it. But the Forest Service, CAL FIRE, it's in charge of protecting us from wildfires and other maladies. It's otherwise, this material literally just turns into greenhouse gases if you did nothing with it. And so it's a new way of looking at things, to create a low carbon or zero carbon transportation fuel that's truly sustainable.
Or maybe it's an old way of looking at things that we're just coming to grips with today, because our new way of thinking proved to be the wrong way of thinking.
Controlled burns. I mean, that's what I was talking about a minute ago, was it was believed for a long time that it was just let the trees fall and let them decay. And that proved to be a colossal mistake. And so in days past and years past, that wildfires were, especially Native American tribes, would let the fires just burn themselves out. And that same thing what we're trying to do, manually today by removing that material. And we have a tremendous amount of work to do, for many years to come to achieve what occurred naturally, maybe a century ago. So
then we have to figure out how to get the hydrogen fuel around, because it's a gas, right?
That's right. So the way that I'm working with the Thule River.
Maybe we should hold that, because we're coming up with a break here in a very short period of time. So just to kind of catch everybody up, I was amazed to learn that Russia shot a rocket to the moon with a little car-sized vehicle that's going to run around on the South Pole of the moon for a while. Why? Because the South Pole of the moon contains water, a lot of water. And with that water, astronauts or whatever kind you call the warriors that go up there to take over the moon are going to need air, and they're going to need something to fuel their rocket ships with. And they can make that air and that rocket fuel out of water. And so we give that a little consideration and realize that hydrogen is popping up all over the place, kind of like mushrooms in the forest floor after a rain. Here they are. We're talking about hydrogen cars. We're talking about hydrogen jets. And it is, unless I'm mistaken, one of the most abundant elements on Earth, hydrogen, H2O. It's almost everywhere. And so today we're picking up hydrogen and wondering, is it possible that the simple element that we all consume every day in water could fuel our future? And according to Mike Keller, it should, because it could do what we've neglected to do for probably 100 years and are paying the price for it today, as we have seen that happened to our good friends in Lahaina. Right back.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
Are you nearly maxed out on your credit cards? It doesn't matter if you're using your credit cards for fun or to survive. At the end of the month, your statements come in, and you can either pay them or you can't. If you can't, late fees and interest rates get tacked on, and now you're struggling just to make the minimum payment due. Do you feel trapped? Am I talking to you? Good, because I personally researched some companies that can help you. They may be able to reduce your credit card balances by 50% and stop the late fees. If you qualify, please call our special debt hotline number right now for a complimentary, free 5-minute consultation. Deal with your credit card problem now before it gets much worse and put more money back in your pocket. Trust me, I've been there too. Call right now.
800-948-6896. 800-948-6896. 800-948-6896. That's 800-948-6896.
When your business is on the move, you must find the right place for it to move. Move it to the right place with the help of the power brokers at J.R. Parrish in Santa Cruz. Let's ask Matt Chelton, general manager of J.R. Parrish, the big question. What about the terms of the lease?
The terms of the lease is where we really prove our value. I mean, where a tenant goes is often like an eye test. They pick the location that's best for them, but then creating a lease document that's fair or advantageous to the tenant or owner is our job. To go in there and figure out what they pay for in addition to the rent, how long the term is, what happens after the initial term, who pays for what in terms of operating expenses of the building, what kind of limitations you have on that. That's kind of where we get involved because of our background. We do this every day. Our tenants do it every 3 to 5 years.
When your business is on the move, move it to the right place with the help of the power brokers at J.R. Parrish in Santa Cruz.
JRParrish.com.
The wife says the boat's got to go, no problem. Stores at Anbar Self-Storage in U-Haul, easy off Highway 1 by the airport. 24-hour security for cars, boats, and RVs. Stored away at Anbar Self-Storage in U-Haul in Freedom.
You made the products, now you have to deliver. Anbar Self-Storage and U-Haul has the moving vans, shipping boxes, and packing materials you need to deliver them. Easy off Highway 1 on Airport Boulevard by the airport. Anbar Self-Storage and U-Haul in Freedom.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about hydrogen and how we're going to convert our world to a hydrogen economy. It sounds fun to me. It sounds clean. It sounds wonderful because we can clear the forests of junk, turn it into hydrogen, and drive off into the sunset or fuel our rocket ships on to the next best place, wherever that might be. So Mike Keller of Michael A. Keller's Associates Consulting, how are we going to make all of this conversion possible?
Well, as I said a few minutes ago, that there's a number of ways to do it. You can take natural gas and split it into hydrogen and CO2, and that's called blue hydrogen. And you have to sequester the CO2, which is not easy, easier said than done. And because the gas is already going through the pipeline, there's the method that I'm using is called green hydrogen. And green hydrogen uses, in this case, it's biomass to hydrogen. And so what we're using is woody biomass, which we use pyrolysis to break it down to make syngas. And that's really location specific. You can't be bringing trees in from, the East Coast to California to do this. You have to use material that's already available. And that material right now is coming from the state's forests. And it's really very convenient, and it's ecologically very useful, very beneficial. And so we bring that material that doesn't, that's no good to anybody else, and we use that to turn that into hydrogen. And then we'll just sell it right there, in the what I call the microbrewery model, where we're making the fuel in the back and selling it in the front. And so fueling stations, in other words, that sell hydrogen. The excess hydrogen, we just turn it into electricity and sell that into the grid or have a private agreement with somebody like a cold storage facility or something like that to turn that into electricity for them. So they're not using fossil fuel or whatever. It reduces the stress on the grid as well. So it's distributed production is really the easiest way to say it.
That's really interesting because my father and his father, I think, operated the last totally vertically integrated petroleum company in the country. At least I think it was them. What they did is they dug a hole in the ground and pumped crude oil out of the hole. And then they pumped that crude oil up to the top of a hill where they had their house, and they built a refinery. And they refined that raw crude oil into various petroleum products and lubrications. And they sold it to farmers and ranchers who came from miles around to get the energy and lubrication to run their farms. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, essentially. And so there's different size. There's a lot of companies that are coming online right now that have, some are very elaborate, like you would, see an oil refinery, and some of them are quite simple, just, kind of like a home size model. And, there's any size in between because the reaction is the same. You just use, high temperature, low oxygen to make this syngas, and you separate it, and there you go. But, you can put it into a pipeline. Technically, you can do it today, but in the United States, it's extremely rare to do it because the hydrogen molecule is so much lighter than a natural gas molecule, and it's just they don't blend well when you put them in. Putting methane from an anaerobic digester into a natural gas pipeline, you can do that, but you can't do it with hydrogen. So shipping it and storing it are the biggest near-term obstacles to the widespread commercialization of hydrogen.
Can they compress it?
Compression costs a tremendous amount of money. You can compress the gas, and or you can liquefy it. And when you liquefy it, it gets it down to it's the lowest temperature of any gas compression that I'm aware of. I think it's true, but it costs a lot of money to do it. So what people are doing is they put it into these fuel cell batteries. These, you know, it's like you see, it would be like a giant over the road truck, except this is a giant fuel cell battery. And a fuel cell will take hydrogen and turn it into electricity. So you can ship it across the country or ship it anywhere and plug it in, and it'll release hydrogen or it'll release electricity. But it's just, these are, I wouldn't, you know, they're the best we can come up with today for the most part, but still it's not very efficient. It'll happen like Lahaina, for example, bless their hearts. You would put a bunch of these fuel cells on site for emergency response to generate electricity, and you know, there's no hydrogen cars really there per se, but that's the kind of utility that these fuel cells will make. And it's the same fuel cell that goes into transportation. So it just converts hydrogen to electricity and drives that electricity to the drivetrain, just like an EV, except it's hydrogen.
Well, it seems like this is the major obstacle then we have to overcome before we can develop a hydrogen economy. It seems like there's just that significant roadblock of transportation. You have a gas that's lighter than just about anything else. And I was thinking, well, you could put it in a dirigible, but that, of course, doesn't make much sense. You know, it's kind of reminiscent of the cellulosic ethanol concept that we worked a number of years ago, whereas all we need to do is dissolve the cellulose in plants and convert them to sugars, and convert the sugars to alcohol, and we have a never-ending source of energy to drive around with. But we never could figure out how to efficiently dissolve the cellulose. And it seems like we're kind of running up against a similar kind of obstacle here. Do you think we can overcome it?
Oh yeah, the number of companies that are working on that exact model, I mean, you described it perfectly, is that they're taking organic or carbon-based material such as a tree and or corn or whatever, and they're adding, you know, a particular enzyme to it that will convert that carbon into a sugar, and then the sugar is then used to produce fuel. So it is a thing. And there's so corn-based ethanol people, producers are they're starting to blend in cellulosic ethanol with their corn-based ethanol, and then to get a lower carbon intensity fuel, and so that's really an up and coming thing. Those facilities take hundreds of thousands of tons of feedstock a year, so you got to have it where you can rely on it year after year after year, regardless of the season, regardless of the economy, and then you have to have a buyer for it on the downstream side. Mm-hmm. So it's and then, you know, not to mention just the capital to build the facility. So most everything can be solved with money, but the feedstock for cellulosic ethanol or to make hydrogen is there's just other challenges involved. What we're doing, I call it small ball. We're taking 100 tons a day of material, which is two truckloads of material, and turning that into up to a metric ton of hydrogen a day, and that is a very doable material handling challenge. There's not much to it, and you can sell that, you know, pretty much immediately. And the carbon credits from the biochar, they're in big demand. And so that's our business model, is just small ball and collect wood from local areas and then turn it into hydrogen and then sell it into that local community.
Kind of like a microbrewer, same principle.
That's exactly, Good idea. That's a great way. I'm going to use it.
I'm going to use that. Okay.
Well, I'm going to use that.
Now, are these slow cooking ovens that you use to get the syngas, are they portable? Can you put them on a trailer and pull them someplace and kind of work the neighborhood?
Well, I guess technically yes, but it's not like, you know, you pull it up one day and start and plug it in the next. There's a lot of them are, they're skid mounted. They come in, but then you have to hook them up. There has to be the infrastructure around it to make it work. Yes, they can do it. It's just more involved than you might think at first blush.
Well, I would assume so. But you made mention also in a conversation previous to the show of something called produced water.
Right. So electrolysis is running water through an electric current, and it separates the hydrogen and oxygen molecule. And water itself is obviously very valuable. What in oil and gas exploration, when they drill for oil, they one of the things that they recover is it's called produced water. So it's water that comes up with the oil or with the gas, and is really full of a lot of nasties and needs to be put back into the ground. And a company in Bakersfield, Renovo, I think is the name of the company, but they figured out a way to a patented process to clean up produced water and into potable water. And it's these plants are very expensive, but we can use that water that's currently not, you know, even before they get it to the potable side, that we can use produced water and use that to produce hydrogen and electricity, et cetera, et cetera. And that is a massive, massive untapped market and is a potential solution for hydrogen production and distribution.
We have a few minutes left, but you made mention of the great breakthroughs that are being made as we speak. How great are those breakthroughs in making hydrogen gas?
Well, the one thing that I think is the most exciting is the ability to use seawater and to in the electrolysis. And salt makes it, there's a chemical reaction challenge to removing or for the salt that gets in the way of the electrolysis and splitting it. One company that I've learned about has figured out a way around that and has commercialized that technology. So you could say, you know, where you could go into a pond or an inlet that has brackish water and that is really no good for anything. And you can take and use that water to produce hydrogen, or you can go to an area. The Salton Sea is an example. You know, they're taking the minerals out of that. I'm not saying that this is a good idea to use the Salton Sea, but as an example, where you have just dead water and use that to produce fuel. And then there's, of course, you know, fresh water, you have rivers and things like that. And there's, I don't know if those are great ideas either, but wherever you have a steady supply of water, then you could easily, you know, produce, you know, use electrolysis. It's very, very efficient. It's way more efficient than using biomass. But again, it's water, and then water is, as you know, is becoming a much more dear commodity than just about anything else on the planet right now.
If you had your choice, which do you think will win the race to the energy future? Would it be the cellulosic ethanol model or the synthetic hydrogen, synfuels?
It's going to be one I didn't say. I'm going to sucker punch you on this one. It's municipal solid waste. And there's technology out there right now that can take MSW, as it's called, and convert that into hydrogen and electricity. And it's so you could have you know, instead of a landfill, you have these machines sitting up there that you bring the material in, it treats it, it turns it into hydrogen and whatnot. The trucks that haul the trash, they would then be running on that hydrogen. And it's way more efficient than trying to capture methane out of a landfill. And you don't have that problem of a sprawling landfill anymore. And it's that technology is here today. And then also plastic, using plastic to produce hydrogen. So all of these things, these technologies are here. They are just on the cusp of becoming commercialized. So it's an exciting time, and I think it's very promising for transportation fuel.
Wow. Good news all the way around from Mike
yes, sir.
Keller of Michael A. Keller and Associates Consulting. Nothing but good news about our energy future, and we'll take it. And we love the idea of going into the forest and clearing all that slash, turning it into fuel, clearing up the forest so they don't burn down. Nothing but good news, Mike. Thank you so much for joining us on The Food Chain. Ladies and gentlemen, remember Michael Olson's, first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. And that's exactly what we're doing.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.